Okay, many thanks, Emanuela, also for the invitation to come here. It's a great pleasure to be talking to an audience of people who, A, who haven't heard my talk before, except for Mark Robbins, probably, and B, who may be completely astounded by some of the things I'm about to say. This is the Burj Khalifa, and I'll be getting back to this a little bit later in a kind of peripheral way. Anyway, what I'm going to be talking about is some work that was carried out over the last few years with a number of collaborators in my group, notably PhD student Nicolas Fernandez, who was involved in a project which Lafarge actually dragged me into, but I was very glad I got dragged into it. And collaborators on that were Lucio Issa, who you're about to hear from, Hans Hermann did some modeling for us from our civil engineering department, his student Romain Mani, and our colleague Juliette Caillé-Barrios in the École Centrale de Lyon. So first of all, a little bit of from my master's course on modes of lubrication. And the reason I'm telling you that is just to give you an idea of how tribologists think about lubrication. Then I'll get into polymer brushes, which is the way that we influence friction on surfaces. And then finally, our experiments with granular flow and polymer brushes. So these are the various kinds of lubrication I teach the students about. I'm only going to deal with a few of them today because only a couple are relevant here, really. So hydrodynamic lubrication, I guess you guys know more about this than I do, where we have this thick lubricant film between the sliding surfaces. And the other one that may not be one you think about very much, but concerns me as a chemist very much, is boundary lubrication. And this is the case where you get down to the situation where you actually have your surfaces coming into contact. Now, when we have hydrodynamic lubrication in a car, in what's not known as a journal bearing, where you have a rod rotating in a cylinder, you have conformal surfaces here. You have the surfaces kept apart by hydrodynamic forces. You need to have a slight non-parallelism so that the fluid coming in can carry the normal load, like the weight of the car, for example. And I usually teach this as being something rather similar to water skiing. You need to have an angle here so that you get the hydrodynamic forces bearing your weight. Now, when we talk about boundary lubrication and hydrodynamic lubrication, often we deal with what's known as the Strydbeck curve. And this is a curve that is usually shown half a dozen times in tribology conferences in different forms. And it shows the coefficient of friction as a function of what's called the Sommerfeld number, the product of the viscosity and the velocity, the sliding speed, I should say, divided by the load. Now, out here is the hydrodynamics. So this, after this morning, I almost hesitate to say this, we are seeing friction here, and it's caused by hydrodynamics. So it's couette flow. As you go up in speed, you get more drag, and that's what we're seeing here. Now, we come to a point, because we're decreasing the thickness as we go to the left-hand side of this axis, we come to a point around here where we start to have asperity-asperity contact, and so part of the load is still carried by hydrodynamics, but part of it involves the surfaces banging into each other, so the asperity is banging into each other, and eventually we get to a point here where we've really got asperity-asperity contact only, and we have a negligible effect of hydrodynamics. So there is this transition from when you start your car and the things are actually in contact, and then as you start to get the lift and it gets up to the right speed, you go through this curve, and we tend to operate bearings somewhere around here in order to avoid the wear that happens in this mixed lubrication region and to have lower friction. Whoops. Now, the boundary lubrication we deal with, if we had nothing there, we'd really have severe wear problems. So to reduce friction and to prevent unnecessary wear, we have boundary lubricants, which are molecules that adhere to the surface, so they chemisorb to the surface or have some other strong interaction, chelation or whatever, and they have long tails typically, and then the shear plane is then this plane between the tails that is much lower in shear strength than a shear plane you would get if the hard surfaces, normally steel, were grunching against each other. Okay, so that's it for the master's course. And now we get into polymer brushes. Now, polymer brushes arise when you take polymer chains and you anchor them onto surfaces by one end. If you have a poor solvent or it's dry, then they just hang out on the surface, and we call this the pancake configuration. But if you put it in a good solvent, then they expand out into the solvent and they adopt a shape something like what they would have if they were floating around in the solvent. So we have a diameter of 2 times the radius of duration, and this is L, the spacing between the chains. Now, as L over 2RG gets smaller, we start to get a stretching out into the good solvent, because the interaction with the solvent is strong and they want to avoid each other, and so there's a free energy term that favors this, so it works against the entropy elasticity, so we end up with what's known as a polymer brush. Okay, this is called a mushroom. Now, there are a number of ways of explaining this, and one way is through theater, and these are the brushettes. The world premiere in Cargès in 2010. Here's Uzi Landman, one of the first brushettes, and they're illustrating what happens when polymer chains come together. And these are some British brushettes, plus one Israeli. This is Jacob Klein, who managed to sneak into this particular rather polydispersed group of polymer chains. And then it's caught on like wildfire. So this was in Madrid and also in Japan. Now, there are a number of ways of making polymer brushes, and we've done both. One is to have a ready-made polymer system that will stick to a surface, so some system with chains and some sort of anchor that will stick to the surface here electrostatically, and in this case we've hooked a lot of them onto a comb. I won't get into the reasons why, but this works very well. And the other is you just grow polymers out of the surface, and we heard an example of that from Professor Sood yesterday, of free radical polymerization, and we've done both of these things, and controlled radical as well. Now, the way we measure friction on a nanoscale is using AFM, so instead of looking at the normal up and down motion of the AFM tip, we're looking at the torsion as we scrape it across the surface, and this enables us to measure friction quantitatively on the nanometer, nanonewton scale. And we also, instead of using the sharp tip people normally use in AFM, we either buy one of these, which we did right at the beginning, but nowadays we make our own, where we get a tipless cantilever, and then we can immobilize any size colloid particle of any material we want on the end of the cantilever. And then we know what the radius is, and so the contact mechanics are rather more straightforward than with a sharp tip. This is one of the molecules we've used, and I'm going to be coming back to these kind of molecules again. It's one of these comb-like molecules, and never mind the chemistry for now. This was the inventor, Jeff Hubble, of this particular molecule. But they have a backbone and they have side chains, rather like glycoproteins, which are natural lubricating molecules. And the way it actually works is as follows. If we have a negatively charged surface, then we can attach the positively charged backbone onto it and spontaneously produce a polymer brush. So you just dip an oxide surface into a solution of this stuff, and then you've got a PEG brush coated surface. So very, very simple electrostatic interaction. And I'm going to be talking about this polymer and also some related polymers that we used for our granular materials experiments. Now, here's an AFM experiment in the days before we calibrated our AFM experiments. I'm afraid it's in arbitrary units, but you still get the point, I think. When we just have water or a buffer solution and we have a borosilicate tip sliding against a silicon wafer, then we get a certain friction force, this slope being the friction coefficient. And it doesn't matter whether it's buffer or water, we get something very similar. And you can see that as we get down to zero normal load, we've still got friction. So that means we've got adhesion here. Now, if we cover one surface with our polymer brush, look, the adhesion's gone, just disappeared. We got the same slope, more or less, but the adhesion component is gone. If we cover both surfaces with our polymer brush, the friction's gone as well. It hasn't gone, of course, but it's below the sensitivity of our detection device here. So we get extremely low friction when we have these polymer brush layers on the surface. And these are the cone polymers I was talking about before. Now, Jacob Klein has talked about the mechanism of this sort of thing, and when you get one polymer brush sliding over another, then there are a number of forces that are important. There's an osmotic pressure that resists the compression of these things. There are entropic forces that resist the interdigitation. And there's a fluid film at the interface that is more obvious when you think of the monomer distribution as you go from one side to the other. It's actually a parabolic fall-off, comes from Kate's work. So in the middle you've got an enrichment in the solvent, and that's the shear plane in this case. So you're getting fluid film lubrication, but in the absence of hydrodynamics. You can get it at as slow speed as you want. It's the brush physics that's giving you the fluid film lubrication here. Now, we can do what we want to these polymers. We can synthesize them as we want. We can have different length of peg chains. We can change the spacing between them. And with lots of different architectures, we find that if we play around with L over 2RG, so the spacing divided by twice the radius of gyration, as we get down into this very brushy regime of 0.5, we get lower and lower coefficient of friction. And we can really tune it as we want by tuning the different architecture. Now, this is a different kind of brush in oil, and I only show it because this enabled us to change the viscosity, and so plot it on a real Strybeck curve where we have the viscosity in the x-axis. And this is the case where there's no polymer on the surface. Here's the hydrodynamic regime where we're getting the friction value for the hydrodynamic regime, and it's all falling on one line, as we would expect. And there are no brushes in this case. We put brushes on, and you see this is just the same because this is the hydrodynamic regime, except this is now stretched out to lower sliding speeds. Because in this case, we go from hydrodynamics into hard, solid contact. So this is the transition mixed regime, and then this is our boundary regime. But in this case, there's no hard contact. We go straight from hydrodynamics into brush contact, which has an order of magnitude or more less coefficient of friction. And as I say, this was done in a bunch of different lubricating oils, petroleum-based lubricating oils. Okay, so getting on to the important point here. So the Burj Al Khalifa. So why did we get into this? It's all about pumping cement slurries. And it turns out concrete is the second most consumed substance on the Earth after water. And 3 tons of concrete are consumed by every person on the planet every year. And production is growing by 2.5% annually. So extraordinary amounts of concrete are being produced. And producing a ton of cement generates a ton of CO2. Now, this, of course, is not good news. Maybe disputed in some parts of this country, but it's not good news if you produce a lot of CO2. And it comes from the reaction itself of producing the Portland cement. 5% of the world's CO2 emissions are due to cement production. It's due to the heating that's necessary in order to convert the limestone into the Portland cement. And it's also just the reaction itself. You're taking a carbonate and you're getting rid of the CO2 from the carbonate to produce the calcium oxide. And then when you make concrete, you mix the cement with all kinds of other stuff and some water. And this is the stuff you know that's in the cement mixers. Now, in order to improve the carbon footprint of the cement industry, what people are doing is they're making concrete with fillers, with rubbish, basically. They're just filling it up with rubbish to bulk it out, so they have to use less Portland cement because it's the Portland cement that generates the CO2. So ash is very popular for this. Ash is a byproduct from power stations, for example. The problem is that you don't just add water randomly when you make cement until it feels like it's a good consistency. You add a stoichiometric amount that is going to react with the Portland cement you put in there. So if you have more ash in there, you put in less water. If you put in too much water, you mess up the properties of the concrete. So you put in just the right amount of water, and then all the filler you've got in there, of course, changes the viscosity. So slurry of cement plus filler is much more viscous than a slurry of cement alone. Now, this brings challenges, and this is where we get into our shear thickening issue. Of course, you know what this is, but we have a problem where we go from our Newtonian regime, and then we're pumping our cement up to the top of the Burj Khalifa. We get discontinuous shear thickening. If we're too impatient, we put too much cement in there, not enough water. We try and do it too fast, the whole lot solidifies. what a mess, right? You have to take a pneumatic drill to it. So it's not a pretty sight. Now, we started thinking about this in terms of lubrication. We're thinking, okay, when we have the fluid load bearing, the hydrodynamic regime, we're not going to get this kind of discontinuous shear thickening. When we start to have this boundary regime where we have the asperities locking into each other, then we are. So in other words, we're making a parallel between our way of looking at this this lubrication process and the way in which most of you would look at it, namely the transition between the Newtonian plateau and the shear thickening regime. Now, we need to measure a lot of things here. We need to measure the friction. We need to measure the phi max for the boundary lubrication case, and then we need to see whether they correlate with each other. And so one of the experimental challenges was, how do you measure the friction between the spheres with and without these friction modifiers here, the polymer brushes, for example? And so Nicolas Fernandez, trained at the Polytechnique and a whiz in solid mechanics, was able to figure out exactly what happens in the atomic force microscope if you take an immobilized sphere on the surface. We sintered spheres into a glass plate, and then you put a sphere on the cantilever, and then you drag one over the other, and you measure the forces. He managed to show us what was going on there, and we actually can see that, for example, in the case of bare, clean silica spheres sliding across each other, we get a friction coefficient of about 1 here. This is the case with the pork fat or the finger grease. In fact, it's after being shocked by this value, I told him to put the spheres out in the lab for a couple of weeks and repeat the experiment, and he got the finger grease result just from dirt in the lab atmosphere. And this is what happens if you take the bare, clean surfaces and you put the polymer brush on it, so a much lower friction. So we took quartz powder, we put various different comb polymers, a slightly different one from the one I showed before, that absorbs in the presence of calcium ions, and we were able to tailor this to be able to get different friction coefficients between 0.6 and 1.1. And then we measured phi max by doing centrifugation up to 2000 Gs and seeing how much it compressed, and this gave us a value of phi max that we could then use to correlate with our friction coefficient here, and we could see the correlation as we plotted one against another. And you can see what happens here in terms of varying the friction coefficient. As we just put our different architectures of polymer on the surface, we can see the change in the continuous shear thickening. And if we're at a high enough value of phi max, we can also see the transition into discontinuous shear thickening. Some of these things Lucio's going to be getting into in more detail, but I'll sum up what I've said here. There seems to be a direct connection between the transitions in the flow regimes and those in our lubrication regimes. The friction seems to determine the maximum volume fraction in the boundary lubricated flows in our experiments. The onset and the nature of the shear thickening transition can be controlled by controlling the lubrication between the particles. And that means we can optimize the polymer brush lubricant additive in order to achieve better flow properties. It means you can be more impatient and push the cement slurry faster up the Burj Khalifa while you're building it. So I started telling you about modes of lubrication and introduced you to the concept of polymer brushes. Talked about potential mechanisms that may be at work when you have polymer brushes sliding over each other. I showed you how in this oil case, you can actually get a more of an order of magnitude difference in the boundary regime while the hydrodynamic regime stays the same because you have the separation between the brushes. Then in the Burj Khalifa case, looking at the particles as actually being surfaces that are sliding over each other, in our case, with their friction reduced with brush adhesion, how we measure the friction between these spheres, how we measure the phi max, and finally looking at the two in correlation and seeing how the friction controlled by our polymer brushes seems to be involving the shear thickening mode. And I'll leave you with a picture of my group and Lucio's group. We do a lot of things together, taken in Figueres in northern Spain last August. Thank you for your attention.
So this this is a naive question for an experimentalist.
So when you plot the Schreibeck curve, for example, you plot it against a Summerfield number, which is eta times u divided by the load. But in most experimental studies that we've seen, instead the x-axis is viscosity times the sliding speed, and you show that actually in the previous slide as well, which seems to collapse the data much better than using the Summerfield number. Is there a reason for that?
Well, we don't change the load. That's the
oh, okay, so you keep the same load. But if you change the load, does that actually normalize when you plot that?
I mean, we haven't done it for this system with polymer brushes. In general, people see it does, but we haven't done it for the polymer brushes. It's just... it's not. It's just a lot easier to vary the other two variables.
Do the superplasticizers that are used to lower the yield stress of cement paste play the same role against shear thickening?
I think some of them probably do, and this is why the cement companies started thinking along those lines. But they weren't designed to change these properties. So I think some of them do, but they're not optimized to have this effect. But what the encouraging thing about the superplasticizers is it shows you can throw quite a large amount of polymer into cement without drastically changing the mechanical properties of the concrete. So I don't think there would be any problem in throwing these polymers into the cement to change the rheological properties.
But do you know if there is some, you can optimize the two properties simultaneously? I mean, low friction and
that, I don't know. I haven't worked with superplasticizers, okay. I'm afraid, so I can't really answer that. There is a concrete expert here. Where is he? Yes.
All of the chemical admixture companies are looking towards that direction.
Great talk. So I just want to understand, if you put ash in there, so you have ash, you got your particles, you got the brushes somewhere, probably on the particles, and then you got a liquid in there. So if you want to get Phi max, do you want to get the amount of filler really up? That's one thing, right? On the other hand, you put your polymer brushes on the particles, not on the ash.
Well,
so,
I mean,
what do you do there? Because I mean, eventually
we're doing neither. In fact, we're putting them on model spheres in this experiment, and Lucio's going to get into what happens when you.
All
put
right. Imagine you would be a.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that you can put. Polymer brushes on everything. I mean, it's just a question of optimizing the adsorption process for whatever the filler is. I mean, there are many different kinds of filler, but one of the things we do in our group is we basically stick anything on anything else, just using different feet. In this case, it was purely electrostatic, but one could consider using other means of sticking to the ash surfaces. So I don't think that would be a problem, but we didn't investigate it. We were looking at model spheres in this experiment.
Great, just for that building, right? Because that's kind of cool. So if I wanted to really pump cement and decrease the carbon footprint and all that, at what point do I really have to worry about what to put in there as a filler? Or do people just throw in almost anything at this stage? Probably not, right?
I think they throw in almost anything right now. I mean, as long as it's going to be compatible with the cement and not interfere with the reaction. Again, I ask our... Where's he gone? Ask our cement expert. You can basically throw in anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest constraint is cost. I mean, you think about concrete,
it's
$100
per
yard. So, I mean, that's the biggest thing. And then besides, you know, just getting your rheological properties, which is, it's a huge thing to get that right. Because if that's wrong, people won't place it. But besides that, you need the strength, you need durability, you have freeze-thaw problems, so a host of other things that need to be met as well. But this rheology issue is definitely one of the top ones.
Can you just say how much ash?
It's 25 to 50% replacement of your cement. But some people, if they can go higher, they'll go higher. The thing is, it really retards the reaction. So that's the big thing. You don't gain the strength for a day later, and that's a big deal for consumers.
Because the particles have to form the connections between them. But I mean, that you can see if you're putting in 50% of fly ash, then you're going to be putting in 50% of the water, and this means a tremendous change in the viscosity. So this is where the problem starts.
Nick.
Hi.
What's the scale of the repulsive pressures that the brushes can withstand before they collapse? Is it in the 10 megapascal range, or?
So thinking back, I mean, it depends very much on the spacing, on the L, or L over 2RG. And just to give you an idea, we have done experiments up to a good portion of a gigapascal between steel surfaces with these brushes, and we've seen a reduction in friction of maybe a factor of two. So I think the issue there is that certainly at the asperity contact, these things are being scraped away. But in the case of those molecules I showed you, they're self-healing, because when you scrape one of these away, they come away intact. The electrostatic forces are all that's holding them. So they come away intact, and then another one can just come down and replace it. So it's a self-healing process. As you scrape it away, more molecules come down to replace it. And we've demonstrated that with fluorescence experiments. You can actually see the molecules coming down from the solution. And so, yeah, I'd say 650 megapascals we've looked at. 200 is we've used quite routinely. And there must be more than that at the asperity-asperity contacts.
But you'd think it would just the entropic force. I mean, so is it the electrostatics then that's maintaining the brush thickness and not just sort of the entropic polymer brush arguments?
No, I think it's the polymer brush. The electrostatics are just anchoring it on the surface.
So I was trying to think, if we go back to Mark's picture before of the asperities that are separated either by the glass or by the inclusions that actually help locking the two surfaces together, which is the closest?
I think neither, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we've got a new surface. I think we've produced a new surface with the brush, which is the brush, mm-hmm. and we've got these two forces that stop the compression and stop the interdigitation, and we're holding apart these hard surfaces, and we've replaced them by something squishy and slippery, and the brush physics gives you a fluid film at the interface. So I think you can't really compare it. I think it's another species.
And everything depends, but on the other hand, everything depends on the layer, what the layer of fluid is doing.
It's the layer of fluid at the interface where the sliding's taking place.
Question.
Yeah, Omar Marie. Do you have an idea of the rolling friction that could be taken by these polymer brush interactions? If I think of two polymer brushes trying to flatten out, for example, under compression, I have a flat contact, and so I can imagine that you can bear a rolling load, right? Do you have an idea of, can you measure something like this? Or?
If I had rolling friction, yes, with polymer brushes?
Yes.
I mean, it's very low because there's very little adhesion. I mean, there's...
But if it's flat, you have a kind of geometrical rolling friction, right?
Why do you call it rolling?
Well, it prevents rolling, right? So if you have two flats... Well,
yes,
if you can deform your brushes so that they have a flat, finite surface, you have a hard time rolling them because you need to compress.
Right.
And can you measure something like this? Or?
I mean, isn't this just a measurement of the compressibility of the brushes?
Possibly, yes. But you have, you could not, for example, with your frost measurement, you did not see anything like rolling or...
No, I mean, we've done real rolling experiments where we deliberately roll one ball over a surface and we see a reduction in friction, but I mean, partly because the adhesion has been removed. And we do a lot of indentation measurements in order to get these mechanical properties of the brushes. This is something we spend a lot of time doing, which is actually very difficult because you can't really see where they start. So you have to figure out a way of figuring out where you encounter the surface, but
yes,
we do measure those compressive properties, and they depend very much on the spacing of the chains and the degree of interaction with the solvent.
Thank you.
So let's thank Nick again.
Thank you.